Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Debbie Light versus Sintel Cellular Company of Texas from Gregg County. Kawasaki Motors Corporation, USA, and Kawasaki Heavy Industries Incorporated versus Kim Y. Thompson. As an ex-friend of Matthew E. Thompson and as personal representative of the state of John Eric Thompson from Grayson County. And Houston Health Clubs Incorporated versus Dave A. Rickey from Harris County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete the arguments before the noon break. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Light versus Sintel Cellular.
May it please the court, Mr. Greg Raychek will present the argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is a restraint of trade case arising out of an employment at-will relationship that contained a covenant not to compete. We must therefore begin our analysis with the basic premise that the covenant not to compete, being in restraint of trade, is unenforceable as against the public policy of the state of Texas. To be enforceable, the covenant not to compete must be both ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement and must be reasonable. What we are concerned with here today is only whether this covenant not to compete in this employment relationship meets this standard. Debbie Light, an experienced salesperson with an established customer base, sought and obtained employment at United Telespectrum, a predecessor to Sintel Cellular. Because of her experience, customer base, and other factors, Debbie Light was granted employment with United Telespectrum and went to work with this company. At this time, she did not sign or agree to a non-competition clause. More than 2 years later, during the employment period, Debbie Light was forced by her employer to sign a non-competition agreement. Over her objection, being told that she had no option, either sign or she would be, in essence, out. Debbie Light, in face of this threat, signed the agreement. This agreement provided no additional consideration of any sort, provided nothing other than the agreement to continue her at-will employment relationship. In fact, the agreement specifically said this employment relationship is at-will. The only thing Debbie Light acquired by signing this agreement was the right to sell the same product she was selling, plus an additional product being added to the product line, that being Cellular Telecom.
Did the agreement provide for a two-week notice if she was going to be terminated? Didn't that affect make that it was an at-will agreement subject to a two-week period of employment?
There was a provision in the standard contract provided to the employee that requested or required, depends on how you look at it, that the employee give 2 weeks notice if they are leaving their employment. The enforceability of that provision is highly questionable for numerous reasons. The first being the employer had no such equal obligation to give any notice for 2 weeks. And therefore, if she's not having to work for 2 weeks, the employer can fire at any time, does she have to stick around for 2 weeks before she can walk away? That would be almost forced servitude.
I misunderstood. It seemed to me from what I was reading that there was an agreement that there would be 2 weeks notice given before termination.
No, Your Honor. My understanding of this contract, as it is, is that the 2 weeks notice was requested that the employee give to the employer. It did not work the other way around. This court has spoken at least twice on the very issue presented here today, and that is the validity of a non-competition agreement in an employment at-will relationship. Justice Hightower, writing for the unanimous court in the case of Martin versus Credit Protection, barely 3.5 years ago, held that since the employment at-will relationship is not binding upon either the employer or the employee, it is not an otherwise enforceable agreement, and therefore fails to meet the first mandatory requirement for a valid non-competition agreement.
Has that been overruled by the legislature?
No, Your Honor, it is our contention that it has not been overruled by the legislature. In fact, the first element the legislature's statute imposes is, in fact, that the non-competition agreement be ancillary to or part of an otherwise enforceable agreement. The legislative statute is clear that, in fact, the very element this court has interpreted in every case this court has addressed this issue.
So you think the legislature did not seek to change the law as articulated by our decisions in Martin and Travel Masters? They merely sought to codify it.
That's an interesting question. There are members who believe that they were changing the law. I do not believe that they were that unaware of what this court's holdings were, that they could not have made that change if they intended to.
Why, if they did not intend to change the law, as articulated by the court in Travel Masters, for example, did they use the phrase for a term or at will in the amendments to Section 15.51?
That provision, 15.51, dealing only with when or who has the burden of proof on the elements of the covenant not to compete, does not, in fact, first change the elements that must be proved. You still must have an agreement that is ancillary to or part of an otherwise enforceable agreement, and it must be reasonable in the elements that are set out. But in an employment relationship, personal services contract type relationship, the burden of proof is placed, whether it's at will or at term, on the employer. The question then is, did that simple phrase, at term or at will, in imposing the burden of proof on the elements it set forth prior to the statute, change the intent of what is an otherwise enforceable agreement? The legislature, if they had wanted to say employment relationships are enforceable agreements under the statute, could have said employment relationships at will are enforceable agreements under this statute. The legislature has not said that. They may have wanted to imply that by this, but is the court under the obligation to read that implication in face of the authority the legislature was looking at, and yet they simply say the burden of proof issue, whether it's at will or at term, you must have the burden of proof on the employer. That's the only change they've made that mentions at will anywhere.
But it does suggest that an agreement can be ancillary, or a covenant can be ancillary to at will employment.
And this court has never held otherwise that, and I guess the distinction I'm drawing is, this court has never said, as legislative history indicates, that you cannot have a covenant not to compete in an employment at will relationship. What this court has said is that the employment at will relationship itself is not an enforceable agreement to which the covenant can be ancillary. There must be something else to base or to have a foundation for that employment at will relationship, for that covenant not to compete. The relationship itself does not form the foundation. There must be something within the employment at will. We'll provide you a car as long as you sign a covenant not to compete. We'll provide you $10,000 for signing this covenant not to compete.
There must be some benefit conferred on the employee.
Just like any
contract,
the covenant not to compete must attach to something that has some future enforceability or some independent valuable consideration.
Why isn't the agreement to employ an individual sufficient consideration to constitute an agreement to which a covenant may attach?
The reason is in the deep-seated at-will status of Texas employment. As long as that employment is at-will, the employer can hire you, have you sign the document, and the next second fire you for no reason at all. And that is perfectly legitimate under Texas law. Now then, we're weighing, well, how long do you have to work to be that adequate consideration for this promise? I mean, you have to work 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. You work 3 days, you have it 1 year at will, or 1 year covenant not to compete. Is that adequate consideration? We get into those battles. Because at will has no future enforceability, either party, for any reason at all, or for no reason at all, can simply step away from that relationship at any time.
The simple fact of employment with no guarantee of future employment is not adequate consideration for a covenant not to compete.
I would contend it's no consideration at all. The employer, when you come walk in his door and he says, go to work for me, and as long as you do certain things, I'm going to pay you, that's past consideration. Once you've done some things, I'm going to give you money. But at any time the employer can step up and say, go away, I don't want to see you no more. There's no rights you have to enforce future obligations under that contract unless you and your employer agree ahead of time. If those future obligations are imposed, then you have a foundation upon which a covenant can be based. And again, we're going back to the nature of a covenant not to compete is extremely harsh. You're telling somebody you may not work at the job that you excel at. You may not do the job that you're good at in your home. You can't do it around where you live because you used to work for this man over here. Who of us have started a business as an attorney who the only reason we were able to start that business is because we developed clients while working for someone else. We earned their trust, and then we went off and opened our law office at the place where we've been practicing all our lives.
Any questions?
Let me ask, finally, do you disagree that the statutory amendments that went into effect September 1st, 1993 apply to this case?
I wholeheartedly agree that those statutes apply to this case for a couple of reasons. One, I believe, as this court has previously said or noted, they don't make a distinction or a difference in the common law, and therefore we don't actually reach that issue. But first, those very statutory provisions being applied retroactively, I feel, are constitutionally infirm. We have addressed that issue in briefing before this court simply because the statute has never been applied to us up to this point, and we've had no opportunity to address that issue.
So you're saying they do not apply?
Exactly. Ms. Light believes that statute has no bearing on the outcome of this case, which the agreement was entered into, the agreement was breached, and the harm was caused before even the first version of the statute came out, much less the second version, which is now in effect.
Let me make sure I understand. Do you agree that the legislature intended by the preamble or to the amendatory act to retroactively apply this? But your contention is it cannot be constitutionally retroactively applied. Did I fairly state that?
Precisely, Your Honor. I believe one of the few things clear about the legislative amendments to the statute is that they intended for it to have retroactive effect. I would contend under Section 16, Article 1 of the Texas Constitution, that application is infirm.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Tim Warmick will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, this particular case involves, as the court well knows, a covenant not to compete entered into between the parties in this case. The issue which has been a bone of contention with regard to the enforceability of that covenant not to compete is whether or not it is ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. However, I would indicate to the court that since 1989 and 1990, the state of the law with respect to this first requirement for enforceability has been somewhat in flux. It's been a little bit in limbo, and I think it's caused some confusion to the employers and the bar of the state. In Justin Bell, the case was decided numerous years ago by this court. The court required that a covenant not to compete be ancillary to another contract or agreement. Section 15.50 came along in 1989 indicating that it needed to be ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. In this court's cases in DeSantis and Juliet Fowler decided in 1990, this court indicated that the covenant not to compete to be enforceable must be ancillary not to an otherwise enforceable agreement, not to a valid contract, but to an otherwise valid relationship or transaction. Then on that same day, the court decided those two cases, the court decided Martin, and indicated that it must be ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. In the Pete Moore Maine case, which was decided by this court in 1991, the court indicated that the covenant not to compete must be ancillary to an otherwise valid relationship or transaction or contract. And then along came the 1993 amendment, which continued to hold that it must be ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, but certainly by indication in Section 15.51 indicated that an at-will arrangement could be an agreement to which the covenant not to compete can be enforceable. Needless to say, there's been a little bit of confusion. However, I would indicate to the court in this case, it makes no difference which of those analyses you apply, because the covenant not to compete in this case is ancillary to any of those. The Court of Appeals in Tyler corrected...
You have just a covenant not to compete in an at-will contract, suppose you're at a McDonald's franchise and you hire a lot of people to make hamburgers, and you have a little employment contract that says we're going to pay you the minimum wage for working 40 hours a week, and when you leave McDonald's you can't make hamburgers for two years. Is that an enforceable covenant not to compete?
I would indicate to the court that it may not be enforceable, but it wouldn't be because it's not ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. It may be that
this enforceable agreement is an agreement to pay the minimum wage.
That's
for
right.
an at-will contract.
And if that employee works for a certain period of time, let's say a two-week period of time, and the employee gets paid every 2 weeks, and let's say that employee works for 2 weeks, and then the employer terminates that employee and doesn't pay for that 2 weeks' wage, certainly that employee has an enforceable right, as per the term of that at-will agreement, to bring a case against that employer to receive the wage that he's due for that 2 weeks. And I would argue
that you'd have
that
even without a contract, wouldn't you?
I would agree. And I would indicate to the court that an at-will employment agreement without a written contract carries with it enforceable terms.
What are they?
Well, I would indicate to the court that, and it's long been held, I think, in this state, that at-will employment relationships are certainly valid. In any employment relationship, there must be agreement. For instance, the employer must...
You said if there wasn't an agreement, it would nevertheless, there would be nevertheless be enforceable obligations. What would they be?
I said that I was incorrect. I meant to say if there was not, it would be enforceable even without a written agreement. Certainly this court recognizes, and this state recognizes, oral contracts, oral employment contracts, which carry with them enforceable terms. If I'm an employee and I have no written contract, I'm an at-will employee, and I have agreed to work for my employer at a certain rate of pay.
He can't reduce it.
Not without, and this court specifically held in Hathaway versus General Mills Inc., that was the 1986 case, that an employer to an employee-at-will relationship cannot modify the terms of that agreement without meeting two requirements. Number one, he must prove that he gave the employee notice of the modification of the terms of that relationship, and number two, they were accepted, just as with any contract.
So he could say, you're fired and I rehire you at 60% of what you make.
If the employee wants to agree to that, that's correct. I think that's true in the employment at-will relationship.
So if I understand your answer to Judge Hightower, if you win this case, establish the law that you say should be established here, and then get hired by McDonald's, you can write up a contract with them for anybody who's flipping hamburgers out there, that if they're on pay every 2 weeks, they can be barred from going down the street to Burger King for the next 2 years.
I disagree with that statement.
Why not?
Just, sorry, I think what I was getting to with Justice Hightower was that it would not be unenforced. That covenant not to compete in our McDonald's scenario would not be unenforceable because it's not ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. However, it may be unenforceable because the employer's need for the protection does not exist, which is another requirement under both the statute and the common law. And so therefore, I think that the employer, in order to make this covenant enforceable, must establish to any court that...
Suppose Burger King's paying a nickel an hour above the minimum wage, and they've been losing a lot of employees at McDonald's, and they got a special way of cooking their hamburgers that's better than anybody else's department at the present. Can they do that?
I think if the employer can prove that there's a need for that protection, such as we have given this employee special secrets into, if they have a special recipe, for instance, it can almost be some type of trade secret, and if they absolutely need the protection, if they can establish that, then in that scenario, I think it's important.
So it might not apply to McDonald's, but you think Pizza Hut would be okay?
It would depend on, of course, it's a question of law as to whether or not that need exists. And I think that is the area of the statute and the common law that would be addressed in that situation, whether or not the need for the protection exists. But as far as whether or not it's ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, I think you can clearly meet that requirement. Because the at-will agreement, whether in writing or not, carries with it enforceable terms.
But the enforceable terms are compensation for labor. That's the quid pro quo. You work for me, I pay you this wage. You perform the labor, you're entitled to the wage. Beyond that, there's no benefit to either an employee or the employer for one to insist upon an additional benefit that precludes exercise of rights by the other without any quid pro quo, without any additional benefit other than the fact that I won't fire you if you sign this.
I think perhaps
the equity.
I think perhaps that goes to another element other than the ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. That goes to consideration. Did the employer provide the employee with adequate?
It goes to the second prong.
I think that's correct.
It must be reasonable.
Well, and I think number one that there must be a need for the protection, and I think then there must be, the terms of it must be reasonable as far as the territory, the time, the activity, but I also think there must be consideration. In other words, I've got to give you some benefit, thus the consideration, in order for you to sign this agreement and give up those rights. I agree with that statement. And I think that can be done, whether it's providing an extra wage, whether it's providing an opportunity to earn an extra wage, such as is the case in this case, whereby my client entered into the sale of a new product, which carried with it much higher commission for the sale of each one of those products, and the need for my client's protection in this particular instance went up immensely when they had their employees sign these agreements, because prior to the time of this agreement, my clients only sold beefers and pastries. But they received a license from the FCC to sell cellular. And when they were getting ready to start selling the cellular product, is when they had their employees sign this agreement. Well, under FCC rules, there can only be two cellular providers for any given area. So that we've got head-to-head competition just between two companies. They were going to be training their employees on cellular products and new cellular products. They were going to be giving them education and training on how they want this particular product sold. They gave them the opportunity to earn higher commissions and more money by selling this product. And in return for that, and the need for the protection that they had, they asked them to sign this agreement.
You say they were going to do that. They were not obliged to do anything. They could also have terminated the employee the next day.
That's correct.
They're going to do all of these things. Why don't they just put that in writing and say, we will keep you on for 6 months and give you all this training, and in exchange for that, then you can't compete with us if you leave.
Well, I think that was put in writing. In this case, the only exception is the term of the contract was not put in writing, other than to say that it was at will. But the fact that we put in writing that we were going to be training you, that's in the contract. Well, that we were going to pay you salary.
It was not enforceable. You didn't have to hire them one more day. Not even one more hour.
I agree with that. But had I not done something during the enforcement that this contract carried with it and said I would do, certainly that's enforceable. And in fact, in this particular case, in the live pleadings at trial, we were sued on a clause of this written contract. The petitioner in this case at trial filed part of her cause of action was that my client had failed to pay her commissions that were due during the time that she was employed by us, pursuant to the written agreement that's before this court. And cited paragraph 2, I believe, of that particular agreement and indicated that we owe her some 600 something in commissions pursuant to our written agreement.
The right to collect compensation for labor performed, is that adequate to preclude you from future earnings elsewhere when the employer can terminate you at the drop of a hat?
I think that depends on the necessity of the protection of the employer. If this is a business and you're an employee wherein they're giving you specific specialized training, they've got customer information and customer lists that they need to be protected, I think indeed that that can be adequate. And that's
supposing they have special training and special training takes 4 months. First week they fired.
The government completely validated. If it was in that particular situation, if the covenant not to compete was signed at sometime at the beginning of the employment prior to the time that you got the training, and the employer can show to the court that there was a need for them have this type of protection. Yes, I think it is adequate, and I think this court has held covenants not to compete enforceable since the early 1960s if they were reasonable, starting with the Weatherford to the old school case. And I think the state of the area of the law has been pretty much settled up until this court's opinion in Hill versus mobile auto trim, and then the legislature stepped in, and then we've had a number of decisions that have come through since that time.
Counsel, since the legislature got involved in this field, and most recently in September of 1993, we had some amendments to the Texas Business and Commerce Code passed. Your adversary agrees that the legislature intended to make those amendments retroactive, but he says they cannot be constitutionally applied to Ms. Light. Would you address that argument?
I will, Your Honor. I disagree with my opposing counsel on that issue. I think that this court has held time and time again a long line of cases which indicate that there must be a retroactive law is not, or a law applied retroactively, is not constitutionally infirm simply because it is to be applied retroactively. Number one, the court looks to see whether or not the legislature intended it to be applied retroactively. I don't think that there's any real contention with regard to this statute. Secondly, this court has applied law retroactively if they did not impair or impede vested rights. And there are cases, and I think it's that correctly hold that the course and conduct of a cause of action is not a vested right until such time as that cause of action has finally been concluded and a final judgment has been rendered. In this particular case, the rights and the enforceability of the covenant not to compete in this case have been in controversy from the beginning. There has been no final conclusion in this case, and I don't think either Ms. Light or my client have any rights which have vested in this covenant not to compete. I would add to that that due to the fact that the legislature's enactment of this statute, in my opinion, really has done nothing than put the law back to the way it was prior to Martin and prior to Travelman, that in essence, there is no new right being given or taken away.
Well, you say it's done nothing but put the law back the way it was. In other words, it's overruled. You contend it's overruled two Supreme Court opinions.
I do. I believe the legislature, and I believe the bill analysis that I attached to my motion for rehearing in this matter indicates that quite clearly, that the legislature intended to overrule Martin and Travelmasters. And by the way the statute reads, it is clear that the legislature conceived and perceived of covenants not to compete which were enforceable that are ancillary to at-will arrangements. And I do not think there's any constitutional infirmity with applying that retroactive in this particular case because I don't think there's any vested right.
In sum, your view is that if the only formal agreement between an employer and employee is a covenant not to compete, and there are no other agreements between them, except that the employer will not fire you immediately if you sign this agreement, but does not promise anything beyond that, that covenant is enforceable as long as it's reasonable.
I think if that is part of the agreement at the very inception of that employment arrangement, I think that indeed can be true.
And the reasonableness includes the element that is necessary for the employer.
That the employer needs the protection.
That's right.
That's right. And as far as the enforceability...
So if the employer needs the protection and gets the employee to sign it, then the employee is stuck.
Unless for some other reason that covenant not to compete is not enforceable. But when you say stuck, I think it's important to understand that the employee is not required to sign. The employee can look for work elsewhere if they don't accept that term or condition of employment. And I think this court has held in Sterner versus Marathon Oil Company that an at-will, non-written at-will employment arrangement is a valid and subsisting contract, which is protected from third parties interfering in it. I can't imagine that an at-will employment contract that is protected from third parties interfering with it do not have and carry with it terms that are not enforceable. And I think the Hathaway versus General Mills case, which is 7-11-227, which is decided by this court, is a perfect example of where an employee who was an at-will employee who had no written contract sued his employer because they attempted to change his commission rate without notifying him, and he was successful. Now that is an enforceable term of an at-will agreement where there is no written contract. And I contend with this court, and I think it is the law, that if you have an at-will arrangement, that carries with it terms such as paying you a salary, that carries with it enforceable agreement or a promise of benefit. In fact, I'm defending a case right now where we have been sued because it is alleged in an at-will relationship with no written contract that my client promised to provide health insurance and did not do so. I don't think that this court or any court would uphold a summary judgment in my favor if I simply said, Your Honor, we may have promised to do that, but this is an at-will relationship. That's not enforceable. I don't think any court would uphold that. Because it certainly is.
The difference here, though, is you're not obliged to provide health care or health insurance another day beyond the employment. This is all in the past. The obligations that you describe are those that have already vested.
Well, I would agree with that, but if I have provided as an employer consideration to the employee to give up those rights, and the employee has accepted consideration to give up her right or his right to compete, then I have paid for that obligation, and they should be required, if the covenant is reasonable, to abide by it.
So, a condition of employment can serve as a basis to provide it.
Depending on,
if you don't do this, I'm going to fire you. If you do this, I'll fire you for at least the next 60 seconds, but you can't compete against me for 2 years if at the end of the 60 seconds I want to can you.
I disagree with that to the extent that no additional consideration is provided in that example. I would agree under the law, and I think appropriately, that in that scenario, if I say, if you don't sign this, I'm going to fire you. In an at-will arrangement, I can fire you without saying that. I can just fire you because I want to. But I can say, however, that I will give you $500 if you'll give up your right to compete against me 2 years after your termination. They take the $500, and I terminate them 60 seconds later. If the other parts of that covenant not to compete are reasonable, I believe under the law, it is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, your opposing counsel is arguing that because of this additional training, which presumably, I guess, made her more employable by other folks, and because of the enhanced, increased commission that his life would be eligible for, with this additional training, the opportunity to sell cellular phones and speakers and papers. This was adequate consideration for the covenant not to completely respond.
Yes, I do have two responses. First, again, since the relationship specifically in the contract is at will, day one, there is nothing she can enforce. They can not let her sell cellular. They can keep her working and not let her sell it. They can keep her working and not let her get these higher commissions, or they can fire her the very next day. There is nothing she can enforce. And two, I did have something.
It'll come to
it may be real. I'll go back into what counsel is attempting to impress this court with, that because in this employment relationship, the employer agrees to pay their employees, that this should be impressive enough to uphold a covenant not to compete. Because the employer agrees to give benefits as long as the employee is working, that this should be good enough. That because they promise to give training that she cannot enforce, training that she cannot impose the employer or enforce the employer to give her, but that they're willing to give her, so they say, the value of that training is to them more than to her, because it's their product they're trying to move. I would point out that the reasonless argument counsel's trying to make really doesn't apply in this case for the very reason that he tried to perform. There are only two cellular markets in a given area. Therefore, the competition knows if there's a car driving down the road, it's got a little antenna for cellular phones, and they're not servicing that person, that's not one of their clients. They can go sell that person. There is no customer list to be protected, because the person, the competitor knows if they're not servicing the person is a potential customer. Either we're using someone else or nobody.
Well, counsel, this case has a little different posture than a typical covenant not to compete case, because the employer never sought to enforce this covenant not to compete, did they? You sued them because they declined to release.
I would argue that they did enforce it by refusing to release it. Not only refusing to release it, but telling her, you go to work for a competitor, we're going to sue you. Her options then are, well, I would take the risk. Go work for an employer, you sue me, and see what kind of devastation you can cost me, or I can seek redress from the courts to get released.
If the trial judge, listening to evidence in your case, in Ms. Light's case, if there had been an attempt to enforce this and preclude her from seeking other competitive employment, she could have asked the trial judge to reform the covenant to make it reasonable if it was not reasonable in the first instance, couldn't she?
That's a difficult question to answer because of the happenings that have gone on in the last 3 years.
Well, I'm sorry, maybe my question is not specific to this case. I guess I should have asked it more generally. If a employer seeks to enjoin a former employee from going to work somewhere else based on a covenant not to compete, and the trial judge thinks it's unreasonable in scope or in time or whatever, the trial judge is within the judge's authority to reform the agreement, is not?
Today, that is correct.
That hasn't always been the case?
That has not always been the case. I believe this court's opinions, pre-first version of the statute, say that it's unreasonable, it's unreasonable, the trial court should not reform, the covenant is simply unenforceable. The first version of the statute says it has to be reasonable in these areas. I'm not sure it clarified whether you could reform or not. Clearly, under the current version of the statute, can be reformed, and in fact, the trial court is under an obligation to reform if it is unreasonable in the areas that are set forth.
So if Ms. Light had been sued by her former employee to stop her from going to work somewhere else, she could have said, Judge, this is unreasonable, and the judge could have reformed it to vary from the terms that she agreed to.
If that happened today, yes, that would be an option she had.
Well, you say today, since the statute's been in effect.
Since the statute's been in effect, since September 1993.
But of course,
it's involved. That's exactly right. This, you can't answer your question. It only assumes there is a valid covenant not to compete in existence. If the covenant is not valid, the court cannot reform it to make it valid. Only if it's valid but unreasonable can it be reformed to be made reasonable.
That was my question.
And I asked about that.
You didn't think this was ancillary to an enforceable agreement. Why did you sue on it?
Because our client, and again, it goes back to what I said before, was faced with a hostage choice. Do I go take this risk, put myself at risk for being sued myself, potentially answering the damage if I'm wrong in my assessment? Or do I go to the court and seek redress, say, I'm being harmed in this way, tell me what my rights are, what can I do, they won't let me work.
But you have already claimed recovery on the basis of this agreement being enforceable.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I understood that your opponents argued that you claimed unpaid commissions due under paragraph 2 of the agreement.
And that's exactly the basic flaw in his argument is everything he's arguing is past consideration. Once we earn salaries, whether we've got a contract or not, under federal law or whatever, we're entitled to the money we've earned. That is not consideration or enforceability into the future.
Well, it's based on contract or quantum merit, right?
Whichever way, and actually there's federal laws that require that to be done. I mean, there are a lot of things that we can rely on to get paid after we perform the services.
Mr. Gray-Chick, I'm sorry. How long did Ms. Light work for this firm after she executed the covenant not to compete?
A very short time. She had worked more than 2 years prior to signing the covenant, and then it was, if memory serves me correctly, it's about 4 months. If I remember correctly, she signed this agreement in October of 1987 and resigned in the early part of 1988.
And it's your position that because the agreement she made was for future performance, that is, not to compete in the future, that could not be part of a transaction that the other party performed in the past. I guess what I'm asking, your argument that all of this stuff is something that happened in the past, that she was kept employed for 4 months and they incurred obligation to pay her in 4 months, that because all of this occurs with something in the past, the fact that part of that agreement provides for future performance, it can't be considered. That's not part of the consideration of this transaction because it's something that happens in the future. And
well, the consideration we're looking at is what goes on from this point on. Neither party can use what's happened in the past as consideration to bootstrap an agreement. Past consideration has never been sufficient for any contract.
Well, didn't this isn't what being argued about is what happened between the 4 months of the time she was kept employed? I mean, isn't part of these commissions for this 4 month period of time? Or maybe I'm wrong.
It may or may not be. I'm not really sure, Your Honor. I think it was having to do with expenses she paid, but as to when, whether it was this 4 months or other 4 months, I don't know. But I would point out that the court in El Paso, Justice Larson, writing for the court, in the case of Burgess versus Permian Court Reporters, addresses about this issue when they say that Permian, the employer, was only required to pay Burgess and give him access to his facilities if he gave him any jobs and if he accepted them. Although both parties did perform under the contract for 2 years, neither was required to do so. That's exactly what we've got here. In an employment at will, neither party is required to do anything on a given day. You get up and you go to this office, nobody is required on that day to do anything. Now, the fact that they do cannot bootstrap an invalid covenant not to compete. There must be an enforceable contract day to day to day. In an employment at will relationship, that's all you've got is the right to be there that day.
If the employer here had agreed to retain this light for 1 week and then agreed to operate from week to week, would that form an enforceable agreement that would support a covenant not to compete?
It would be our position that then we jump to the next issue, what are reasonable restrictions on a one-week employment? Can we restrict somebody from working for 2 years if we've only given them 1 week's worth of employment?
But you wouldn't be arguing the validity of the agreement.
There would be an enforceability provision in that contract. And that's the very problem we have here, is this employer did not want to commit itself to its employee in any way. It did not want to commit to give you specific training. If the employer would have simply said, we will provide you with this school to train you in how to sell cellular telephones. We will give you a 6-month school or a 3-month school or whatever. And in exchange for that, you give us a covenant not to compete. There is then something enforceable that she's entitled to at that point, a week's agreement. We will employ you for at least a week. You've got a week's agreement. You've got something to enforce. Then the covenant can attach to it, and then you start evaluating whether it was reasonable.
Whereas, as far as the compensation is concerned, she's entitled to that only if she sells.
Only if she's already performed the service in the back.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience is going to rise.